For the past 2 years, Myanmar has recorded the most deaths and injuries from landmines and explosive remnants of war of any country in the world. In 2024, reported casualties more than doubled from the previous year, in statistics that assuredly undercount the devastation caused by these terrible weapons. Although Myanmar had already seen decades of landmine contamination, since the 2021 coup and subsequent conflict, there's been a sharp increase in the deadly and indiscriminate use of anti-personnel mines, with children and other civilians suffering the consequences. People are being maimed and killed in the course of their daily lives, shattering families and disrupting livelihoods, with a persistent threat that could last generations. Insight Myanmar's in-depth series titled Navigating a Minefield explores the situation on the ground, impacts on survivors and communities, and humanitarian mine action making a difference at the local, national, and international levels. We are joining a network of independent news media publishing in Burmese, ethnic language, and English, both in Myanmar and in the diaspora, to raise awareness about the dangers of landmines and explosive remnants of war, as well as action that can save lives and support community leadership. More information about the series is available on the Insight Myanmar website under the Mine Action section.
Welcome to the Inside Myanmar podcast. My name is Jeremy. I'm sitting in for this episode of the Navigating a Minefield series. Over the course of this series, we've been going in depth on different aspects of landmine and explosive ordnance, interviewing Myanmar and international experts really on perspectives covering humanitarian mine action, victim assistance, human rights, security, and community welfare. One key theme that we've discovered throughout this is that the effects of landmines go far beyond the battlefield. We keep in mind the people who are affected, the victims, the survivors, their families, and the communities that are affected throughout. As one of our guests has said before, landmines have become a living system of control in Myanmar that shape how people move, walk, and survive. For today, we're going to take a step back and we're going to look at the international context, throwing it back and how it affects Myanmar, but also look at the efforts in international humanitarian mine action, the history of disarmament and the land ban treaty, international law, and trends worldwide. Today, we're joined by Aaron Hunt, Executive Director of Mines Action Canada, a civil society organization that has become a powerful advocate for international disarmament. Thank you for joining us, Aaron.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeremy. It's lovely to be here.
And for your background, you have more than 20 years' experience in landmine education and international disarmament. And for MAC, Mines Action Canada, I think the founding is about 10 years before that in the 1990s, in a process that coincided with the development and the impetus towards the Landmine Ban Treaty, which is also known as the Ottawa Treaty. So could you give us a little bit about your background and about the MAC's background as well?
Yeah, so I started as a volunteer when I was an undergraduate student, talking to high school students about the Ottawa Treaty because it was still relatively brand new. And as Canadians, we're quite proud of this treaty that saves lives around the world. Mines Action Canada, as you said, was around for about 10 years before I started as a volunteer. And that was, like you mentioned, part of the process, what we call the Ottawa process, to create this treaty. So in the early 1990s, there were a number of humanitarian and human rights organizations that were on the ground around the world doing development, serving refugees, providing healthcare. And they started to realize that landmines were causing a massive problem. It was causing injuries, killing people, preventing aid workers from getting where they need to be. And the international law we had at the time just wasn't quite adequate. So just so people know, like when I say international law, I'm meaning what's called international humanitarian law or the laws of armed conflict. Often people just know about the Geneva Conventions. And the Geneva Conventions say that you need to not target the sick, the injured, and the prisoners of war or civilians. But there's more to international law than just that. There's that principle of distinction, being able to tell the difference between people who are fighting and people who aren't. And then there's also things like proportionality, where if you're going to accidentally cause harm to civilians, it needs to be proportional to your military advantage. And you need to have precaution in your attacks. You need to be careful that what you're doing isn't going to harm other people, that you don't intend to harm. So what they were looking at is they're like, okay, we have these principles, we have these laws already. We even have some restrictions on how landmines are used. But you know what? It's still the children, it's still the farmers, it's still the refugees, still the aid workers who are getting killed and injured. So we need new law. And Mines Action Canada was founded by a group of Canadian organizations that heard about what was happening internationally and decided to join up with the international campaign to ban landmines as a bit of a Canadian campaign. And now we're a standalone organization that's been heavily involved in this movement since almost the beginning.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I would like to know more about actually what restrictions there were on landmine use at an international level before the Mine Ban Treaty. And then also, as we get more into the different aspects of international law, we can continue to develop that further in the conversation. But also, I'm interested in this differences between customary international law and then the obligations that are under the Mine Ban Treaty as well. So if you could first address what limitations there were prior to the Mine Ban Treaty, mm-hmm. and then what has changed since the Mine Ban Treaty was passed in 1997.
Sure. So before the Ottawa Treaty, there was a convention that was negotiated in the 1970s, 1980s, and it's called the Convention on Conventional Weapons, which I always say it's the reason you can't let lawyers name things. But it's a group of sub-treaties that talk about how countries are supposed to use what they call conventional weapons. So that means not nuclear weapons, not chemical weapons, not biological weapons, sort of the normal weapons that you would think of. And one of the protocols with under the Convention on Conventional Weapons, which we call CCW because it's easier to say, was on anti-personnel landmines. And it's the Protocol 2, and then they amended it a bit to try and address some of these humanitarian concerns. So we now call it Amended Protocol 2 of the CCW. And Amended Protocol 2 talks about the need for states to fence and mark where they use landmines, to map them. And for some countries that are outside the Ottawa Treaty, that is still their main sort of piece of law dictating how they use landmines. But what we found was that that was just not sufficient to actually protect people. So then that's where the Ottawa process started. There was an attempt to make more amendments under CCW, but that just did not pass through the state's parties there. So then the Ottawa process sort of took a step outside CCW, outside the UN, and negotiated a standalone treaty. And then when it comes to international law, I mean, some of the principles I mentioned are sort of encoded in law. So the whole Geneva Conventions, which is what everyone thinks are the only laws of war, they're not. Those are really about codifying this principle of distinction, that you need to always tell the difference between people who are participating in the hostilities and people who are not. There's a whole branch of international humanitarian law called Hague Law, which is about the means and methods of warfare, as opposed to who you like, how you treat people. And so within Hague Law, there are some specific sort of obligations of states in terms of, you know, proportionality and ensuring that weapons don't cause superfluous injury. And that might be the first time I have said superfluous properly in an interview. So everyone, please note this for me. So, weapons shouldn't cause extra injury to people. And that's one of the things that a lot of people have said that landmines do, that the injuries they cause are beyond what is necessary to achieve a military objective.
Sure. And going back to that principle of distinction as well, if you could talk a little bit about what differentiates anti-personnel mines from other weapons of war, and the indiscriminate nature of these mines. And one story, these stories that we hear, and actually I would like to say landmines, and then also the unexploded ordnance that is just littering former conflict zones and former conflict zones all throughout Myanmar. And we keep hearing these stories about children being attracted to these items and mistaking them for toys. And with the anti-personnel mines, them being hidden in different areas where it's clearly endangering civilians. And in some cases, it's been found by Amnesty International, other human rights organizations, targeting civilians specifically. And it's important here to point out that many armed actors in Myanmar are using these weapons, but as our other guests have pointed out, that the way that they use them and the strategy behind them differs for the different armed actors. But you can certainly see a pattern with the military's use where it's specifically being deployed and planted in civilian areas near places of worship, near people's houses, on civilian transport routes. This is very common. So if you could address that aspect in terms of IHL and international law.
Yeah, sure. So I'm not a lawyer, so I will do my best on this. And always, when you're looking at legal questions on this, it's always really good to check out the International Committee of the Red Cross. But this whole idea of distinction, I think, is probably the most important legal concept when we're talking about landmines. So the law says at all times you must be able to distinguish between those participating in the armed conflict and those who are not, whether they're civilians, whether they're injured. The fancy word is hors de combat, so they're outside of combat now, or whether they've been taken prisoner. And you have to protect those specific groups of people who are not participating. And the problem with anti-personnel landmines is their very nature makes them indiscriminate. You put them in the ground and you have put them in the ground, on the ground, and you have no control over who is going to step on them. The weapon itself cannot tell the difference between a soldier stepping on it, or a kid on the way to school, or your grandma on her way to the place of worship. The landmine itself cannot be controlled of who it's going to target. So that is why they're immensely problematic under distinction. You mentioned explosive remnants of war, and that's where it gets a little bit more complicated, because though explosive remnants of war are generally mistakes, they're things that were supposed to blow up and maybe were being used in a way in line with distinction, maybe. So maybe it was originally targeted at a military object, but, you know, it didn't blow up when it hit the ground, and that makes it now a piece of live explosive on the ground. So the explosive remnants of war have the same impact, but they're not inherently indiscriminate.
And so that raises the question, and take this first in the context of the Ottawa Treaty, is there isn't any central enforcement mechanism within the treaty. I mean, there's no way to punish a state party there's no mechanism, to my knowledge, that through the courts, and we know that there are legal proceedings that are being applied against the Myanmar military. We have the case that's being brought in regards to persecution, I would say genocide of the Rohingya. There's a recent legal action that's in process now being brought by Timor-Leste. What are the legal mechanisms and enforcement mechanisms that are embedded in this treaty and other aspects of international law that are, if not forcing compliance, that are encouraging compliance?
Yeah, so the Ottawa Treaty only applies to the countries that have joined it, and Myanmar has not joined it. So nothing in the Ottawa Treaty can be officially used to provide accountability for those who are using landmines in whether or not they're targeting civilians or they're just using them willy-nilly. What you can see then is specifically targeting civilians, using indiscriminate weapons in a way that violates customary international law or other aspects of international law, is where you probably could find some levers for accountability through the International Court of Justice or the International Criminal Court. But for states that have joined the Ottawa Treaty, states are supposed to have national implementation legislation. So you're supposed to take the treaty and adopt it into your national laws. In Canada, it's a specific piece of legislation that made using, possessing, producing anti-personnel landmines a crime with specific criminal punishments of fines and jail time. In other countries, they're able to just sort of absorb the treaty into their legal system. So on an individual level, that's where you would find the accountability for violations of the treaty. The international level, the treaty has Article 8 that lays out sort of compliance processes. That includes, you know, getting the Secretary General involved, getting, doing fact-finding missions and then seeing what the evidence shows, because, you know, different parties can say different things about different states' behaviors. So we need to make sure that we have all the evidence and all of that. So from there, like most international law, there's not like you broke international humanitarian law, global jail. that we can put people in. And so then we have to, you know, find a different ways to get accountability and provide the victims with some level of justice.
Sure. And in addition to Myanmar not being a state party, we know that also major powers have not signed on to this. The United States, Russia, China have never been signatories. And which goes exactly to your point about the durability of international law, in many different conflict situations. And am I correct then in thinking that a large measure of encouraging compliance is norm building and is transparency, and it's the reporting that are built into the treaty to get the state parties that have signed on to encourage compliance and transparency so that they encouraging each other as they go along, just as during the Ottawa process, those countries that supported a ban were also encouraging each other to take that step.
Yeah, universalizing the treaty is what we call like encouraging other countries to join it is an obligation under the treaty. So you're supposed to talk to your allies and anyone really about joining the treaty. And what we also see a lot of is the strength of the norm. We see this both with anti-personnel landmines, and the best example I probably have of this is with cluster munitions, which are banned under a similar treaty a few years after the Ottawa process. And at the height of the Syrian civil war, the Syrian regime, the Assad regime, was using cluster munitions frequently on sort of areas it didn't have under its control. And the Cluster Munition Coalition, similar to the International Campaign to Ban Landmines, it was, you know, calling this out in the UN, talking about it all the time. And the main representative that was speaking in New York most often on this at one point got followed outside the room by the Syrian delegate, who begged her to please stop saying they were using cluster munitions. He didn't dispute the fact that they were. He was just like, could you just stop saying that we are? Because it makes us look bad. So didn't quite get to the level of going to 100% change our behavior, but they were very conscious of the international implications of being seen as using this banned weapon. And you see that even with countries that are outside the treaty, if you hear, if they think their opponent or their enemy is using landmines, they will make a huge fuss about it, even if it isn't banned for either state, because they know that it's going to be viewed negatively by the international community. And it's quite taboo. So these norms do have an impact, even on the states that are using them. But the biggest impact is probably that not a lot of states do. Myanmar is absolutely an outsider in the international community, being where the government itself is using landmines. Most current landmine users are non-state actors. There are very few governments that use anti-personnel landmines on a regular basis. Most years, two or three at most are using landmines, and one of them is Myanmar. So we see that the global, even the countries outside the treaty, you mentioned the US and China, neither of them are using landmines, and neither of them have used landmines in decades. And then I think one of the more interesting pieces of work that people have done is focusing on the financial aspects and the trade of landmines. So there's almost no global trade in anti-personnel landmines right now. The few countries that are considering using landmines, they're having to find new manufacturers and get people to start making landmines because there's so little global trade. And people have been using their financial power. So if you are banking with international banks, you can check with them and find out what their policy is on investing in companies that produce landmines. And a lot of international banks will have a policy against controversial weapons, and landmines are usually one of the number one weapons that are prohibited under that ban or under those policies. So the treaty has also dried up the supply in that it's not profitable to make landmines anymore.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I mean, one thing we hear time and again is the military, Myanmar military's industrial complex has a production of landmines that is now decades old, and also that different armed groups have begun to shown great ingenuity in terms of improvised explosive devices and repurposing landmines, which of course is another concern, is the reusing and keeping them as a threat in the environment. I want to return to a point that you mentioned. Of course, in the Myanmar context, the landmine monitor says the same, is that Myanmar is one of the few governments that continues to deploy landmines. In the Myanmar context, of course, whether the military is a government is a very contested concept. The military, the regime since the military takeover in 2021 isn't internationally recognized. The resistance national unity government asserts its own claim. And so identifying a government is a contested issue for sure. As political but I would also say that in terms of international relations, and this is certainly true in the context of the United Nations, but also with many of Myanmar's neighbors, not having a clear central authority, a government, a internationally recognized government, creates a quandary in terms of how different groups interact and who they interact with and where they seek credentials from. I mean, this is a very complex topic and a very sensitive topic in Myanmar too, where people see recognition of the military as, especially after the recent elections, which were dubious, to put it mildly, that they see that legitimization is strengthening what is essentially not a government. But in that context as well, Myanmar, like other countries, has this variety of non-state armed groups that are increasingly, in this really terrible conflict, increasingly deploying landmines as well. And whereas the Ottawa Treaty focuses on the state parties, what are the levers of influence and regulation for the non-state armed groups? And I know that some of the non-state armed groups in Myanmar have signed deeds of commitment or made statements saying that they abhorred the use of landmines, that they recognize that they caused harm to civilians, and then in some statements also saying that they have no choice but to use these weapons facing, I'm paraphrasing, in an asymmetrical war faced against the overwhelming power of the military. So what about the levers and international action in terms of non-state armed groups, because this is clearly an issue that is not just relevant to Myanmar, but is relevant to conflicts all over the world now.
Yeah, I think the deeds of commitment and the statements that you mentioned are one of the prime levers that actors, that the sort of treaty movement have been using. Usually those are sort of supported by civil society organizations that sort of specialize in their conversations with non-state armed groups, and then other sort of neutral bodies like the International Committee of the Red Crescent, who can go in and speak about international law and the rules of war and the Ottawa Treaty to non-state armed groups. And for different countries, other countries, I think they do have a couple other levers on non-state armed groups. We see sanctions being used a lot on sort of individuals and non-state armed groups that might be acting in violation of international law. So if the international community notices enough, they may use perhaps sanctions, and maybe one of the references could be the use of landmines. I don't have an example off the top of my head of that, but I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility. But most international law is designed to operate at the interstate level, not the intra or inside of state level. So we do get a little bit of a issue there of the distinction between domestic law and international law, and who is considered an actor under those two different bodies. But I think, you know, in the Myanmar context, with such a level of messiness, lack of a better word, of the official representation and government and all of that, I think speaking to everyone that we can is really important. So getting messages through every different actor at different levels, I don't think, because that any indication of being spoken to by the international campaign, I don't think would indicate recognition, because we'll talk to most civil society on this. We'll talk to anyone, because we don't want anyone using landmines. Like, if you want me to go talk to a grade 8 class because some kids for an experiment in class tried to make their own landmine, like, I'll go talk to that class. Not because I think they're an international actor, but I think the norm of the Ottawa Treaty obviously needs to be strengthened in that class. So I think, you know, there's a lot of room for some actions there, even if the law doesn't really focus on anything that happens within state borders.
Sure, that makes sense. And in the Myanmar context as well, what we see, and I know that MAC is engaged with this, is that education and awareness raising, there's, you know, when we talk about the pillars of humanitarian mine action, there isn't really, some of those pillars aren't really going on in Myanmar. I mean, there isn't clearance going on according to international standards. There's clearance going on, ad hoc clearance going on by different armed groups and communities all the time, because people need to live their lives. Exceedingly dangerous and, you know, usually not greatly supported by international action. But we know that there's not destruction of stockpiles. What we do see is education is going on, explosive ordnance risk education, called mine risk education, called various different things. There is victim assistance, and with a great emphasis, we've heard from multiple guests, the importance of social integration and victims being champions for themselves in terms of reintegrating with society and overcoming stereotype and bias. And then also we see advocacy. And this, of course, is sometimes quiet advocacy, working with armed groups to try to influence behavior. I don't think in the Myanmar context that the military is particularly receptive to any sort of pressures to curb these kind of violations of IHL. Their airstrike campaigns clearly target civilians all the time. I don't think that they're going to be pressured on the landmine issue, but we have heard from guests that for other armed groups, perhaps the most potent lever on them is community action. And it's the people, you know, these groups come from their these communities, and it's the public reaction and the public having agency in that context. When we talk about international law, and going back to that subject, though, to just take this very wide-angled view, You know, to put it bluntly, the world is a mess right now. We see, you know, conflicts are proliferating all over the place. We see major actors publicly talking about IHL violations, about violating international law. There's apparent, you know, contested accounts of targeting civilian infrastructure in the ongoing war between United States, Israel, and Iran. We see that international law, as what many people have seen as a rules-based order, is under a threat in ways that maybe we haven't seen for years, and maybe that people took for granted defense of human rights and IHL standards. Can you address that? And in terms of your work advancing, I'm not hoping that you're going to solve the problem right here and now, but how do you keep advancing, and where do you see hope in terms of advancing humanitarian disarmament in that context?
Yeah, I think probably the most important thing to consider when we're looking at the state of the world and everything that's going on with international law is that often people hold international law to a higher standard than they hold like general criminal law, for example. So we would never say in a country that, you know, there's been a huge increase in shoplifting. Therefore, the rules-based order of that country is collapsing, you know, or we wouldn't say, I mean, numerous countries have huge problems with domestic violence and violence against women, which violates, you know, assault laws, sexual assault laws, the laws against murder and all these things. But we never say that the criminal justice system is collapsing just because, you know, so we have to, you know, sort of take a pullback that means violations of the law, especially when they're being recognized as violations, doesn't mean that the system is collapsing. Or that it's, you know, ruptured, which is the words of my prime minister. I think one of the things that people are really being struck by right now is, yeah, we're seeing the impact of what these violations do to people at a scale that we've never really seen before. The images coming out of, for example, Gaza over the past few years have made it very clear what, you know, not implementing distinction looks like, and it's horrific. So we might be seeing a lot more of this, but it's also, I think, for the general public, strengthening people's belief in the need for these principles and the international law system to work. And I think one of the really nice things about working on landmines, which is a very weird sentence, a way to start a sentence, I recognize, is that, you know, even if there are states that are using, there are non-state actors that are using, that we're still seeing far too many victims every year, the treaty is still working. They are still, the law still works. We are still pulling landmines out of the ground because that's a legal obligation for the states that have joined the treaty. Victim assistance is still happening. Survivors are still getting assistance. Children are still being taught to try and stay safe around mines because risk education is also a legal requirement under this treaty. So all of these obligations under the treaty, these positive obligations that states have, these are all being implemented and they're changing people's lives on a daily basis. So, but they're not, you know, big flashy explosions, and they're not horrific comments made by men in suits behind podiums. So people overlook all these ways that the international legal system and international law is helping people on a daily basis. I'm lucky because I get to see that as part of my job. And I think, you know, it is a failing of myself and others to not highlight this enough. And it's something I'm trying to do, but there's, as you mentioned, a lot of different dumpster fires we're trying to put out all at once right now. So unfortunately, telling this success story, I think is getting pushed aside a little bit, but maybe it's what we need now, because people need to see that the systems we've built, especially all these systems that have come out of like the horrors of World War II and the like colonial wars and the Cold War, that all these systems that we built, they were there for a reason. And just because they've been very successful recently and you've stopped seeing, you know, tens of thousands of landmine casualties a year, you sort of forget how horrific these are, unless you're living in a village in Myanmar surrounded by mines, and then it's way too real. But sometimes the folks making decisions in the fancy buildings around the world, it's too remote for them, and they forget. So it's all of our duty to remind them.
Point taken. Yeah, point taken. I think that I would, as I understand that, when we see these crises in these targeting of civilians and often deliberate targeting of the civilians, it's actually all the more reason to look to international law and to redouble efforts for accountability under international law. In the Myanmar context, we've had guests who have said, there's just no national redress. There's going to be no national legal proceeding in the current circumstances that is going to provide any redress. And so they have to look to international law, and which is continuing in different forum. And maybe the argument that it's not perfect, or that, you know, these crimes continue, is not an argument for abandoning international law, but an argument for strengthening it. If we go directly to the landmine treaty, and again, point taken, that perhaps quietly these successes are going on and people's lives are being saved. We don't always hear the news when someone's life is being saved. I think there are now, I want to say 164 countries that are signed on to the Ban Treaty, but also there have just been 5 withdrawals from the treaty as well. And this is the Baltics, Finland, and Poland, pretty much is a direct result of the invasion, the full-scale invasion of Ukraine and the threat that is perceived from Russia. I also, in researching, saw that there have been 2 new signatories as well, Marshall Islands and Tonga in 2025. But do you see these flare-ups of conflict and these interstate conflicts that we're seeing now as a threat to the existing commitments of state parties to the treaty? And what is the state of the treaty now in terms of these withdrawals, and how do we repair that?
Yeah, it's been a very eventful 2025 for the Ottawa Treaty. We are now up to, we're at 161 states parties when you take the new states that have come in and the states that have withdrawn. One of the things I learned there is that the Baltics hate being called the Baltics, and they like to be listed off individually. So unfortunately for this conversation, I'll be saying a lot of Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland. So it'll take up a bit of your time. And this is really what I was thinking about when I mentioned earlier that the success of the treaty is actually becoming a bit of a problem. So these 5 countries all have security concerns, especially regarding Russia following the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And they all have very long history with Russia, and their citizens are, you know, pretty rightfully scared. And so they're saying to the government, we need to be protected. You need to do something about this threat. And you know, Russia is huge. And none of these countries are very large. They are all now part of wider alliances and all these sorts of things. But they still felt the need to show their citizens that they were doing everything they could to keep them safe. And so they looked around and they were like, all right, what else can we do? We're seeing how Russia fights in Ukraine. Maybe they're also looking at the Russian involvement in Syria. And for some reason, they looked at all of this, and the thing that they decided to pick up was anti-personnel landmine use. There are a lot of anti-personnel landmines are being used in Russia, or by Russia in Ukraine. There's reports that Ukraine is using mines as well. But we don't want to violate the treaty, so we're going to leave the treaty. And I mean, I've had conversations with representatives from all of these countries, and they really say they're leaving this treaty because they left the treaty because they have to show their country they're going to do something. A lot of them recognize that anti-personnel landmines are not going to stop a Russian invasion. They're barely going to slow it down. Most evidence we have would indicate that anti-personnel landmines might slow down ground troops by a couple hours at best. But if you look at what's happening in Ukraine, if you've looked at Russian involvement in Syria, it's going to be artillery. It's going to be aerial bombardment, and it would be drones. Anti-personnel landmines have nothing to do with any of those. We did have five countries leave the treaty, but they did it in a way that they said, you know, we still agree with the treaty. Our situation is just different, which I have a whole other thing on that one. And a lot of them honestly believe that it's going to keep people safe. However, the evidence we have is that the people most likely to be harmed by any landmines put on the borders of these countries with Russia are going to be their own people. You know, we haven't seen that many landmine casualties in Europe recently because the Ottawa Treaty is so successful. The number of global casualties has gone down from over 20,000 a year to, you know, somewhere between 3,000 and 6,000 a year. And so the humanitarian impact of these weapons, I think, has been forgotten by a lot of these countries. It's obviously been a challenge for the treaty. We've never had withdrawals before. This is actually very unprecedented when it comes to international humanitarian law treaties and treaties about conventional weapons. But what we have seen is that the other states' parties have come out quite strongly in support of the treaty. We've seen, you know, strong statements from states' parties. We have seen that there is actually now controversy in a number of these withdrawal states because they had really quick legislative processes to pass the necessary withdrawal decisions through their parliaments. And now countries are talking about starting producing landmines or putting them on the border. And that's not what their parliamentarians were told was going to happen. They were told that we're just leaving the treaty now in case we need it in the future, not. So there's, you know, upset parliamentarians in a number of these countries. And I think once citizens start to realize what living with landmines is like, I don't think these are going to be popular decisions. So I do believe all of these countries will be back inside the treaty. I hope they come back before too many of their citizens are killed or injured by their own mines, whether they are civilians or whether they are military personnel. In looking at this, one of the more shocking things I saw was a study from the Australian of the Australian military in Vietnam and the really surprisingly high proportion of Australian casualties that came from their own minefield outside their base in Vietnam in the 1960s and 70s. I don't have the numbers with me right now, but I seem to remember something being like 10% of the casualties came from their own minefield. And I don't think any of these countries want to be seeing that many casualties come from their own weapons.
Yes, that makes sense. And what you said about military necessity in terms of these withdrawals from the landmine treaty, that also resonates with what we've heard from guests about the Myanmar situation, is that often landmines are being used in ways that tactically, for military experts, don't make that much sense. And there's a real question about the military utility. And I think that goes to sort of the heart of IHL, which balances military necessity against those principles of distinction. In that context, again, what we see, and as you know, for Myanmar, has registered the highest numbers of casualties of any country in the world for the past 2 years, more than doubled, according to the last landmine monitor, which is a real concern. When you talk about the engagement that you've had with these countries that have withdrawn recently, that's one aspect of what Mines Action Canada does, right? Is you are interacting at this state level to influence behavior for advocacy, but then also you have other outreach efforts that are based on civil society as well. And I know that youth are a focus, and that also there is a strong gender dimension in your work as well. And I think that relates back to the Women, Peace, and Security platform. That, of course, comes from that, you know, hallmark Security Council resolution that was passed in 2000, Resolution 1325, which encourages and really calls for women's full participation in the security agenda, and both in terms of gender dimensions of conflict, but also women's leadership. So if you could address those two aspects as well, please, the youth aspect and the gender perspectives.
Yeah, sure. I think, you know, to be honest, those two aspects of our work are sort of two sides of the same coin. And that coin is highlighting the people that are implementing the treaty that might get overlooked. So I think a lot of people hear, you know, landmines treaty, mine action, and they assume dudes with military experience. But for a lot of people, a lot of places around the world, that's not who are out here in the field implementing the Ottawa Treaty, doing the landmine clearance, doing the risk education, doing the victim assistance, doing the advocacy. One of the things that Mac has seen is that a lot of the people doing the work at the grassroots level are young people and youth. And when we say youth, we mean sort of like 18 to 30-year-olds. We're not saying that, you know, 12-year-olds are out here clearing landmines. And so what we saw was we have a lot of these people that know exactly what's happening on the ground, because they're the ones doing it. But the international multilateral space isn't designed for the folks from the ground, especially young people and especially women. Especially young women. So we have a youth program that's called the Mine Action Fellows, and it is majority young women, because we've looked around also the meeting rooms, and it is a lot of men in suits at the multilateral level, at the international level. So our youth program versus the gender balance of the meeting rooms. So right now it's anywhere from 30 to 35% women in these international meetings. So our youth program is 30 to 35% men and the rest women. And we provide support and training so that these young people can take their on-the-ground experience and share it with the decision makers at the international level. And that means everything from, you know, how to talk to diplomats to how to get the headset to work so you can hear the statements in the different languages at the UN. And, you know, how to write statements that will go into the official record, how to present your work at briefing events and all of these different things. And then another, as you mentioned, another aspect really closely tied to this, obviously, is the leadership of women in the sector and making sure that there is space for the women who are doing this work to be recognized for their leadership and be able to do it safely and be, you know, their expertise being respected. And it has, you know, that perception of it being a lot of ex-military dudes is still there. I mean, I still get occasionally little comments, despite being in the sector for over 20 years. I get a lot of emails addressed to Mr. Hunt because people would just assume that I must be a man if I have this role in this work. But we are seeing progress there. This year I'm co-chairing the Gender and Diversity in Mine Action Working Group, which is 14 organizations in the mine action sector who have come together to speak sort of with one voice on promoting gender mainstreaming, both at the policy level, which is mostly where I work, and at the field level. And we, you know, work with the governments, work with the national mine action authorities. We work with the diplomats to get the strongest possible policy about women's leadership and gender mainstreaming into the treaties so that the treaty can be a tool to help you help states meet their obligations under 1325, as you mentioned there. That resolution about women, peace, and security from 2000 actually does mention the role of women in mine action. So it's a really natural fit that we're trying to get the states to see, because sometimes you have people who, you have your WPS people, your women, peace, and security people, and you have your mine action people, and those two groups don't always talk to each other. So that's one of the things that we're really working on last year and this year, and I think for the next couple of years, is to get these two groups to talk to each other. So yeah, both of these programs are really highlighting that there are people doing this work. You just might not see them as much. And one of the things that MAC really tries to do is create the space so you can see the work that youth are doing, the work that women are doing, and recognize that there is a lot of expertise there that we're going to need if we are going to achieve the goals of the Ottawa Treaty.
It's interesting. I mean, I think that in international development circles, and certainly in my area in terms of international journalism, we are very used to, and for my entire career, I've been used to working with really strong women leaders and professionals, and many of my bosses, and we see that gender equality has progressed so much in so many of these areas, and that within humanitarian mine action, maybe there's more work to be done. So there is full participation opportunity and leadership opportunity as well. I would say also, following up on that point, is what you said about youth and women in terms of implementation of mine action are also, you know, powerhouses in terms of meaningful action. And translating what is happening in the international meeting rooms into concrete action on the ground that actually makes a difference, and that that has to be inclusive in order for to really lift up communities as a whole. And there are, we know that typically, I think that the casualties from anti-personnel mines tends to skew male. I think it tends to be men and boys. But we know that the consequences include not just the victims and the survivors, but their families and the community and the social fabric. And so could you address also just the gender dimensions and how women and girls can be affected by landmines, but also in these conflict situations, and how there can be intersecting vulnerabilities, and how those can be addressed by the programs, you know, from embedding gender perspectives in programs and in action from the very beginning?
Yeah, okay, that's a big question. The statistics show that sort of most casualties are men and boys. And I think there's a few reasons behind that. And obviously this depends on sort of location and culture and everything, where men and boys often have more freedom in communities to go outside the home, outside of sort of domestic spaces, and therefore are more at risk. And then, you know, young boys often are more culturally prone to risk taking. And unfortunately, in areas affected by landmines and other explosive remnants of war, being prone to risk taking can have very deadly consequences there. Often men and boys are more likely to be the direct victims. And that results in a few different things. Also, like I said, cultural gender norms play a lot into this of how it affects women and girls. But often, a girl is more likely to be pulled out of school to look after her brother or her father. Losing the main breadwinner in a family, or them becoming disabled and unable to work, or unable to work in their previous occupation, may force women to change careers or to start working outside the home, which then might require more girls to stay home. And a lot of the sort of caregiving responsibilities are going to fall on the women and girls. And then when women and girls are directly impacted, they can face challenges accessing appropriate care. In some countries around the world, you know, women and girls need women physiotherapists and other healthcare providers. And if there are no women providing those services, the women and girls just don't get that support and don't get those services they need to be able to return to their previous level of engagement. And, you know, stigma against women and girls with disabilities is different than the stigma against boys and men with disabilities in terms of marriageability, in terms of spouses staying with a partner after accidents. Women and girls with disabilities are at much higher risk of abuse and sexual assault than women and girls without disabilities, and especially in complex humanitarian situations where, like armed conflict, that risk is even more highly pronounced. Yeah, you see sort of all these different sort of overlapping variables here that will depend on, are dependent on, you know, how the impact of landmines are seen on a different community level. And when when we're talking about addressing the conflict, or sorry, addressing the impact of landmines, we cannot afford to only include half the population. Women and girls, especially, well, women can have a massive impact on the communities, whether it's clearance, whether it's risk education. In a lot of countries around the world, you have to have women doing risk education, or else you cannot speak to the women of a community. And you need to speak to the women of the community to ensure they get the right risk education messages and to know what to prioritize in terms of clearance. You only talk to the men, you only find out what's important for where the men go in the community. If fetching water is a woman's task and the area around the water source is heavily mined, you might not hear about that unless you talk to the women. So we cannot afford to not include the whole population in our work to end landmines.
Of course, that makes sense. And I think what you touched upon as well is there are these intersecting vulnerabilities in terms of, and this is not just in Myanmar, this is in conflict situations, crisis situations the world over, where, when a community is under shock, there are higher incidences of gender-based violence, there are higher incidents of trafficking, and that the solutions have to be intersectoral. They have to engage the reality of the situation and try to solve these problems in that fashion. As we begin to wrap up, I want to return back to the Ottawa Treaty. And you had talked about a victim of its own successes. And let's celebrate those successes in the sense that this has become a model, really, or at least it's an aspiration of what a humanitarian disarmament can achieve. And from reading the work and the thoughts of the people who were involved in that process, there was a couple of key points there. You know, it was circumventing the normal bureaucratic processes by, this sort of dynamo that was the International Campaign to Ban Landmines that brought together all of these, as you mentioned before, brought together all of these different humanitarian organizations. It was outreach. It was the personal connections, the personal dynamism of some of the leaders, including Jody Williams, who was the founding coordinator of ICBL. And when I know that Mines Action Canada, your work is not just about landmines. You are involved also in what these other areas of proliferating and it seems often technology fueled conflict. You have, I believe it's Stop Killer Robots. You're active in opposing autonomous weapon systems in that sense, which of course is very relevant now with this recent controversy over AI being used in the United States military. You're also, I believe, active in campaigns not just prohibition of nuclear weapons, but the abolition, if I'm correct. And can you tell me, in a two-part, how has the Ottawa process and the Ottawa Treaty informed these actions? And when you look at where we are now with these emerging technologies and these new forms of warfare, what is the clarion call that you see in terms of what we need to do now to anticipate and meet these threats?
We're closing off with a good double barrel question there. So Mines Action Canada, our mandate is to end the suffering caused by indiscriminate and inhumane weapons. And that emerged from our work on landmines. And then the Ottawa process inspired the Cluster Munition Coalition, which we co-founded, that eventually resulted in the convention or the Cluster Munition Convention, very similar to the Ottawa Treaty. It also inspired the creation of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN, who took a similar humanitarian approach to nuclear weapons. And all three of those campaigns really highlighted a couple things. One is expertise from survivors. The people that have lived with these weapons, that have been impacted by these weapons, they are the experts on these weapons. You do not need a PhD in strategic studies to understand that hiding explosives in the ground for anyone to step on them is bad, or that a weapon that can drop explosives anywhere on a football field is indiscriminate, or that destroying a city with a single bomb is unacceptable. We were also involved in the International Network on Explosive Weapons, which has resulted in a political declaration on using explosive weapons in cities and towns. And that is a different sort of tool, unlike the ICBL, the CMC, and ICANN, which focused on international law. And then now we're also a co-founder and steering committee member of Stop Killer Robots, which is hoping to sort of add to a new treaty there, focused on weapons that are able to use sensor data and algorithms or artificial intelligence to choose who it applies force to or who it targets. And as I mentioned, a lot of the lessons from the Ottawa process come through all of these treaties. They're all focused on looking at what the harm is to civilians and focusing our work on reducing that harm, and to recognizing the expertise in civil society and in affected communities, and working with groups of like-minded states to make progress. And realizing that even if there are some states that are not participating or not in line with everyone else, we can still make progress there. And I think a lot of these lessons still apply. And as we're facing evolving and emerging technology being applied to weapons and to war there with autonomous weapon systems, or AI being involved in targeting and decision support, we still need to ground our technology we're using in conflict, our international law. We still need to ground all of this in what is the impact to the people on the ground? How can we reduce the impact on civilians? And I think this is where people overestimate AI and want to try and find an easy solution. People think, you know, AI won't get angry, so therefore it won't commit war crimes. Misunderstanding that, you know, a lot of what our war crimes are not necessarily done out of anger, but are done as part of a strategy to perhaps break a civilian population. So these new forms of warfare, a lot of them are just new ways of doing old things. And we just need to make sure that the international law can catch up to those. And the big issue with sort of the rise of AI in weapons and in warfare is the lack of accountability and the potential for mistakes with no one to be held accountable. I mean, if a AI system targets the wrong person or the wrong building, who is going to be accountable? Especially if there was no person reviewing it. Right now, if a school is bombed, if a civilian is shot on the street, there are mechanisms for the person who made that decision to be held accountable. But when that decision is being made by an algorithm or a large language model, who's going to be held accountable? And I think that's a big question. And I think it's a question that a lot of people who live in armed conflict are asking, because they realize that this is going to affect them and need to know that there are still limits to war.
Sure. The points that you make me think of the importance of documentation with an eye to future accountability. What you said about often attacks against civilian are strategic, that is certainly resonates with the Myanmar context. And as far as I'm aware, there hasn't been major impacts on the battlefield from AI, but we see technology adoption, most notably in drones, and often targeting civilians, that, and this is in Myanmar context, but in other conflict contexts as well, is the adoption and the innovation is proceeding at a breakneck pace. And it seems that the urgency for consensus, for international consensus, for norm building, for international law, needs to match that pace as much as it can. So your points are very well taken in that regard.
I think possibly the most important message for folks to hear is that, you know, those of you who are living with landmines in your community and are opposed to this and recognize the harm that it's causing, that you're not by yourself. There is a global movement against these weapons, and we all have a shared goal to end that suffering and end the use of these indiscriminate weapons. So we might not be moving as fast as any of us would like, but we will get there eventually.
Thank you for that point. And thank you for appearing on the podcast, Aaron. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Insight Myanmar Podcast. As with many of our conversations, the one you just heard shines a light on a pressing issue regarding the challenges and complexities now being faced by Myanmar and its people. These stories are powerful and necessary to raise our awareness. But the real value of having our awareness raised comes when it can be translated into some type of positive action. And this is where our pitch comes in. One such action could be supporting us in producing more episodes like this one so that we can continue to air diverse stories and perspectives about what's really happening in Myanmar. This will help raise the awareness and reaching even more listeners who themselves might be propelled to take some type of positive action. As you might imagine, we do have production costs, and it's mainly the generous support of our listeners that enables us to continue this important work in amplifying voices that need to be heard. And so by contributing, you're not just supporting a podcast, you're helping to create space for solutions to emerge, for stories to inspire change, and for awareness to develop into meaningful action. If you believe in the importance of these conversations and want to help us in keeping them going, visit insightmyanmar.org/donation. Together, we can make sure that these critical conversations continue to inspire action and change. Yarananda, 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 Yarananda,